Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Stetson with Ruth Ann on Marte Field. How are you doing tonight, Ruth Ann?
Hi, Brian. I'm great. I'm looking forward to 2015.
Well, I mean, it's always good to.
Obama
put it when it comes to the prior administration committing war crimes. We must look forward, not backward.
Wasn't that a choice?
So we'll start off 2015 looking forward and not backward.
Well, that's true.
You know, that had to be,
if we're charging those people with war crimes, I mean, that's fine and should be done. Just like other countries.
That's why they have to stay in this country.
They don't dare go anywhere else, except Bush can fly to Paraguay where they've got, you know, all those hundreds of thousands of acres they bought up. But,
yes, as brought to us by our prior guest, Danny Whale. He was very informative, and he also talked about how the two families, the Clinton family and the Bush family, buddied up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, it's pretty open. It's in the mainstream media, just on the Ed Show today. They showed an interview with George W. Bush stating basically that I consider Bill my brother from another mother, and Hillary Clinton is his sister-in-law, which is just bizarre. What's that?
Years ago when the first President Bush and Bill Clinton were touring, I mean, I was saying that's his other son. I mean, I was right.
We love the Bush family. It's just that there's some minor ideological differences between us.
Yeah.
You know, which is like really bizarre. I mean, it's a Father Bush, among other things, unilateral action against Panama, which killed anywhere from 3,000 to 10,000 innocent Panamanians. To get at that time, we considered evil dictator Muriel Manuega. I can't pronounce his name. You remember?
Noriega.
Noriega. Thank you very much. Thank you. who basically was working for the CIA up until that point, you know, but played two sides of things. But the innocent deaths was hardly talked about in the media at all. Completely whitewashed, and of course, as a unilateral action, Son Bush basically did the same thing with Iraq, which led up to the deaths of probably over a million innocent Iraqis, and so we have a family of war criminals, really, that should be societal outcasts, not the next door neighbors that we've come to love. So it's surreal, I think. And so we have two plutocratic families that love each other, except claim they have slight differences, and from them will come our choices for president for the next 2016 election, Jeb versus Hillary, which should, frankly, frighten people. I have two out-of-touch people that are favored by the rich elite.
They're warmongers. They're both warmongers.
Yeah. They're both war hawks. Yeah.
Neither of them are for the people at all.
No. I mean, Hillary is slightly more liberal and probably would be more likely to pass, say, a general minimum wage increase. But, I mean, it's throwing breadcrumbs at the people, really.
Exactly.
I mean, for the most part, it's going to be the same push for free trade agreements and so forth that in the long run destroy the middle class. It's just bizarre.
More
And
money for
the rich
army.
Definitely want them. I mean, the last survey, there was a survey done on millionaires and billionaires, and over a third want Hillary Clinton, and 16% of them favor Bush. And I think the third place favorite is Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey and so forth. And actually, you have 4% of the rich elites favor Bernie Sanders, so you have a few rich elites. That's not a total surprise. You have a few rich that have a conscience. If you go back into the early history of this country, when the Socialist Party existed, there was a few rich people that threw money at them. But for the most part, no. I mean, for the most part, most of the elites tend to look at for their own interest, as they would in this system of capitalism. Yeah, but definitely it hurts the democracy, or we have a precious little democracy as a result. You can pretty much tell who's going to win a campaign by who gets the most money, because that's the most advertising dollars as a result. I guess I wanted to say something about class consciousness, but there isn't any in our society. If there is, people would be upset about this very fact alone. You know, that basically we have plutocrats that are well connected to other plutocrats who pretty much are determining the nature of the politics and are going to be put forth as presidential candidates and so forth. You know, but it's not just... I just got off the phone a short while ago with some girl. I've been trying to meet somebody. I mean, after Gloria passed away, I get a little lonely. And just got off the phone with this girl from Colombia that just had an extreme hatred of the poor. You know, and she hears it. It's just... I mean, that kind of mentality, it's not just here, but it's not in all countries. I mean, Colombia, I could understand, very right-wing government, probably in their media. It's the only South American country that's really considered a close ally of the United States. Just about every other country has thrown out U.S. military bases. You know?
Well, but let me ask you, Brian, speaking of that, what about Paraguay, I can't pronounce it. They do not have an extradition agreement, evidently. So that's why Bush can be done. He can travel there. And, you know, they bought up all the land and all. So what about Paraguay? Do you think?
Interesting, wasn't it? There was a right-wing coup in Paraguay just within the past 5 years. I can't remember the exact date. But you had a left-wing government in Paraguay that was allied with, at that time, Hugo Chavez was alive. And there was a coup that kicked the guy out, and a more right-wing government that was more aligned with the interest of mainly crop growers, you know, large agricultural concerns, essentially took over the country, Paraguay. And that's probably why. There were some articles suggesting that that coup was CIA-inspired. You'd have to Google the history of it. I recall, because I can't remember the name of the leader at that time. There were two right-wing coups that occurred since Obama's been in office, actually. One in Central America and one in Paraguay. You know, but it was suggested that there was a CIA-backed coup, but there wasn't really any evidence for it. There was no smoking gun. So you have people that write these things, but if they don't really have anything to back it. But, I mean, it wouldn't be a surprise.
No, not
and
a bit.
And looked how it worked out for the Bush family. And Father Bush kept his ties with the CIA, you know, even, you know, in retirement. Although at this point, I think the guy is I think he's suffering from a bit of senile dementia. I mean, he's way up in age, and he's not what he used to be, Father Bush.
Well, that'd be good.
I can't imagine he has any decision making.
I mean, that is not what it used
anymore.
To be. It could be a good thing. Not
no.
that I want anyone to be senile and all that, but
No, I can't say
he was no prize.
No, well, I mean, it would make sense. You know, it fits in a lot.
Yep.
We'll have to encourage people to research it. But yeah, that is interesting. What was do you recall what it was? Why the Bushes owned that land in Paraguay?
Well, they somebody, and it wasn't like W or his wife or somebody. I'm not sure if it was actually a Bush or a Bush representative that went and bought. Well, one reason that they got that land in Paraguay was
right.
because it's over that huge aquifer. And you know how now water is being privatized. So that's
and that aquifer was at the border of four countries or something.
Yeah,
I think Danny Whale talked about it, and yeah,
water
yeah, so.
Is distributed to four countries. Yeah. Yeah, so that's scary
the wonderful
right
Bush,
there.
the
that's
wonderful Bush family. But, you know, and Hillary has been equally as bad.
Please.
Regarding Haiti, though.
Haiti?
I mean, so.
My God.
Yeah.
They partially wrecked Haiti. I mean, them and some others made it much worse than it was.
Well,
so,
I mean, the garment industry projects that her and Bill helped set up in Haiti. They're known for getting away with paying below the legal minimum wage in that country, which is already extremely low. So
right.
it's
and all
an
the
element
charities,
of criminality there, too.
The charities?
Yeah.
He and
mm-hmm.
somebody else from one of the charities he was working with, they were being sued by some of the people in Haiti for fraud, of course. I mean, money didn't go where it was supposed to. Is that a surprise? No.
Well, all that money, you think it would have completely rebuilt Haitian society. But you had rubble on the streets from the earthquake for several years before anything
was
touched.
Well, a lot
of
the money that was pledged never made it.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, actually, from what I understand or what I read, was money that the U.S. pledged. And it never got there.
It's called theft.
That's what it's called. Yeah, that's the word. So,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes you just have to shake your head and, just continue on.
Yes, our guest.
Right, who is optimistic, he's optimistic to the point that, I mean, man, he's running for office, and I'm saying, good for you. So you want to introduce him and bring him on?
Sure. Didier Ortiz, he's down here in South Florida. He's co-chair of the Broward Green Party and an active member of the Dream Defenders. He's currently running for commissioner in Fort Lauderdale's District 8. He's a firm supporter of human rights, respected community activists, most recently speaking out against the city's food sharing ban and other homeless hate laws. He was a key organizer in a march to shut down Fort Lauderdale's Winterfest parade earlier this month. The purpose of the march to shut down the parade was to raise awareness of the ongoing police brutality that's been occurring in a number of our cities. Hello, Didier. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Didier?
Yes, you are pronouncing it correctly. Just a small correction, is District 3 of Fort Lauderdale.
Okay. I was just going to ask, because that's
what
I pronounced, but yeah, okay.
Oh, what did I say?
You said District 8.
8? Oh, so sorry.
They look similar, but yeah.
District 3.
yeah.
Sorry about that. Where is District 3 located, and what's its population?
Fort Lauderdale.
Yes, it's located in Fort Lauderdale. The exact population, I don't know, but the number of registered voters are around 25,000 people.
Okay.
25,000 registered.
And what part of the city of Fort Lauderdale is, to be a tad more specific?
It's the westernmost district in Fort Lauderdale. The western part of it is in 441. And it and it starts west of downtown Fort Lauderdale.
Can I ask you what the Dream Defenders are, Didier?
Well, the Dream Defenders are basically Black and Brown youth-led organization that was formed in the wake of the Trayvon Martin incident. And so, you know, I'm a member, and, you know, and there's many members throughout the state of Florida. And basically, they're focused on social justice and on challenging the status quo and the power structures that be, that create great tragedies and suffering in the color communities of America.
Okay.
What inspired your activism?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with my background, my faith. You know, as a Christian, I spent many years in youth ministry and obviously looking towards a better life and what was around me and seeing the conditions of the youth in the place where I lived. It convinced me that there needed to be a fundamental change in society and in what we call government. So
What's your denomination?
I don't really have a denomination. I mean, I consider myself a Christian, and I don't have a denomination. I think that the denomination that would be, you know, you could say roughly close to what I believe would be the Presbyterian Church, but I wouldn't call myself that. Yeah.
Okay. But you were saying before I interrupted.
Okay, Protestant, then, yeah.
Right, and so basically, you know, I realized that youth change was needed, and I focused more on activism and focused more on politics. That led me to my bachelor's.
Didier, you moved away from the phone.
I'm sorry?
Dieter,
come back to the phone.
There you go. Sorry about that.
There you go.
As I was saying, you know, it led me to more activism, more political consciousness, and to my bachelor's in political science.
Okay.
So you have a bachelor's in political science.
Yes.
Now, I guess I've been asked to mention that your background's primarily working class. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, my parents are immigrants, and they worked hard their entire life, but, you know, the fact of the matter is that
you're fuzzy.
Hold on, let me see. Hold on. Better now? Hello?
Okay, just try to keep the phone in one consistent position.
Yes.
Yeah. But you were saying your families are immigrants from what country?
From Peru. Immigrant family, they were a hardworking family, they were a working class family, we're still a working class family, and that affects the way that I see politics, that affects the way that I see the power relations between the working class and the ruling class and the sometimes conflicted middle class, you know.
When did you decide to run for city council?
Well, you know, I made a final decision at the beginning of this year. I was thinking about, you know, about that since last year. You know, I was looking at how our city council was, the reality that the commission doesn't represent anyone but the few wealthy to-do people that did vote and just is there to serve them, you know. So I decided that I needed to run. Around that time, I actually joined the Green Party, you know, at the beginning of the year. And, you know, just dedicated a lot of time to the party and a lot of time to the campaign. And here I am, you know, I'm 6 weeks away from the election.
Well, I'd like to see other people do what you're doing, breaking away from the two-party duopoly and trying to, on any level, from local to national, run for office. I think that's admirable. What were some of the requirements in terms of gathering signatures, or was there some cost to getting on the ballot and so forth?
Right. Well, it costs $400 to get on the ballot.
Okay.
Basically, the alternative is to try to get 1% of the elected voters to sign off on you running a petition.
Okay.
If you do that, then you only pay $25 for the processing fee, and then you pay $100 to the city to put your name on the ballot. If you don't get those signatures, then it's $400.
Did you do sort of both, or what did you do?
Well, I'm collecting signatures, but qualifying, which is when you pay the money, is it's actually next week. It starts next week, so I may or may not have enough votes. If I don't, I mean, if enough signatures. If I don't, then I just have to pay the fee.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's good that you're going out to getting the signatures, because at least that introduces you to people. I mean, have you? Has that been your primary campaigning so far? Is door-to-door handshaking and so forth, or how else are you getting your name out there?
Right. Well, there's been door-to-door and there's been handshaking. Of course, we collected a lot of signatures by standing outside the most visited precinct in the district during the primary elections in August and the elections in November.
Am I right? That's just 250 signatures.
251, yeah.
Right. Okay, 251, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's, well, technically it will be 250 plus point something, but that just means one more.
Now, when is this election? It's actually coming up pretty soon. It's a special election, isn't it?
Yes, February the 10th is the first round of elections. The top
two candidates
go off to the March 10th elections. However, if a candidate gets more than 50% of the vote on the first election, then that candidate wins automatically.
Wow. So, I mean, February 7th election, that's going to have an awfully low voter turnout, isn't it?
February the 10th, yeah.
February 10th. So that's going to have a very low voter turnout, I would assume, right? Because awareness.
It usually has a low voter turnout, but the fact that we've had even lower voter turnouts in the past few elections, I don't know. Maybe it might be good for me, it might be bad for me, but definitely, regardless, I would like to see as many people as possible.
Yeah, obviously. So you have to get out as much as possible, I would assume. Because low voter turnout elections tend to favor the activists in those districts that just focus on, you know, the same old thing, which is exactly what you don't want. What are you doing to primarily get your name out there so far?
So far it's been the signatures, getting people, asking people.
Okay, that's what I thought.
For me, knocking, you know, we stood outside of the precinct. I stood outside of with some other folks outside of populated, you know, marketplace. There's still a lot more to do. Mailings, primarily, a lot of mailings, a lot of targeted mailings to particular demographics at the right times. And more door knocking.
Mailings usually take money, though.
Yes, they do. But they have an advantage over other forms of campaigning because imagination, if well done. I've done a lot of research, you know, in my political science degree about the history of, you know, of electoral campaigning, and it's pretty scary. There were, and I forgot which school this was. I'm going to say it's either the University of Chicago or Yale, and they started researching, you know, how to get out the vote, like, 100 years ago. And if you look back, some of their tactics were crazy. They, in one of their research experiments, they actually went ahead and sent voters their own voter history with the threat that if they did not vote, the people who sent out that mailing would let their neighbors know if they voted or not. It was crazy.
Oh, good heavens, really? So they would violate privacy?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. They had other things. They had a huge, like a fake huge check sent in the mail. Well, not huge, but, you know, bigger than usual, and they would say vote. It was all these crazy stuff. I forget the name of the book, but you can probably just Google, you know, the new
University of
Chicago.
The search kind of thing. Yeah. What would you say make up the key parts of your campaign?
The key parts are putting a camera on every police officer.
Okay.
Another key part would include the Ban the Box campaign, which is basically a campaign to get rid of those boxes in job applications that say, check if you've ever been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor, because we feel that is a way to discriminate against workers who would otherwise be eligible, and
it
limits their opportunities in getting work, especially if you're somebody who has been a victim of the war on drugs.
Yes.
Another you know, really big platform that I'm running on is to start monetary, I'm sorry, participatory budgeting program like they have in Brazil now, and like they've developed in Hillsborough, North Carolina, and that they're actually working on in St. Petersburg, Florida. And it's basically a system in which community members come together and hash out a city budget. And that would include all the taxes. It wouldn't be a grant. It wouldn't be a trust. It would be all the taxes, right? All the taxes in the city. And they would vote on those, and that would become their binding budget plan for the following year. And
actually, I hear there's a community in New York that's trying something like that, too, having community meetings where they discuss the local budget of just that area. So it's a
great
good
idea.
Yeah,
it's, I know. And obviously I'm running to go against the homeless hate laws, which, you know, it's something, it's a cause of mine and of many people here in Fort Lauderdale. You know, as you may have heard, the city commission passed a series of very draconian laws, and one which banned the sharing of food with the homeless here in Fort Lauderdale.
That is I think that's an issue that reaches across both sides of the aisle, I've noticed. I mean, outside of some of the more nuttier business owners and out-of-touch right-wingers, I've noticed that, for the most part, most people don't like it. They feel offended by it. I think that's one that you can successfully talk about wherever you go and get perhaps some new voters to participate in the special election.
Yeah, it's been an interesting cause. I mean, it brings people of faith, it brings anarchists, it brings regular liberals, it just brings anyone that's a sort of decent human being to our side. You know, it's actually interesting because we had a rally. You know, with hosted by different organizers, including Jeff Weinberger of Fort Lauderdale as well, and the Unitarian Universalist Church, and you see, even Zionists came to participate. It was crazy because some of these people that showed up to that rally were in a counter rally to a pro-Gaza rally that I was a part of in the summer. But regardless, you know, we tolerated each other, albeit, you know, I believe that the state of Israel is a
It does bring people together, I notice. I mean, I participated in a few of the protests myself, smaller ones, against some of the specific restaurants owned by Tim Petrell, who is treasurer of the Downtown Development Authority. He's been one of the key lobbyists for that law. And I noticed that when we talked to people and so forth, that were eating outside the restaurants, I mean, for the most part, they agreed. They agreed with the protest. They didn't want to hop up and participate with the protest. But, I mean, they silently said, yeah, we agree, it's wrong, and so forth. Really, only rarely did you see somebody, you know, shout something ugly. I mean, for the most part, it's an issue that I think unifies people and realize that perhaps, you know, a few wealthy business owners went a tad too far this time.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
You know, I mean, especially since there's, what, now at this point there's over 10,000 homeless, I think, in Broward County.
Really?
And the shelters, I think, are only for 600 or so, maybe 1,200. If you double it up.
It's a disgrace. I mean, and they put all these restrictions on the homeless, such as they have to, in some shelters, you got to be in the shelter by 3 p.m., you know? And so how are you supposed to get a job when you have to be, you know, back home, supposedly, or back in your bed so early in the day, you know? And so a lot of these shelters, I think, are part of the problem in the sense that they work to somewhat treat the rash or the wound in the consciousness of people that like to think that they're not doing anything wrong while upholding their own privilege in society. So I think there needs to be a very fundamental way in the sense of our perspective about charities and what their role is and whether or not they're a solution or just a bandage in wait for the solution, you know?
Well, I think the shelters are even not even owned by the city, but by the county. I think the city is doing nothing, actually, come to think of it. Just refers it to, just passes the buck on to somebody else. What's Fort Lauderdale's main source of revenue?
Tourism.
Because there isn't much in the way of local taxes from what I've seen.
No, it's a lot of it's tourism. I mean, Fort Lauderdale is a tourist city. It used to be a spring break city until the city government kind of pushed against that. But a lot of tourism, a lot of old money, a lot of, power and privilege in Fort Lauderdale, except, of course, in the minority-majority district of District 3.
Oh, good heavens. Has there been an increase in police brutality in Fort Lauderdale itself? Now, I know there's been a few stories that have come back in the news that occurred over the years in Miami-Dade County, such as a street artist that was shot down for doing graffiti, basically, I think. I think it was about a year ago.
Israel Rifa Hernandez?
That's probably it. You probably know the story better than me. You want to go ahead.
Oh yeah, so is there more police brutality? Yeah, there's an investigator that they have on us, on activists. They know a lot of stuff. They know where to look, you know, so this man this particular officer, he's tasked to do that, and that's what he does. It's just, the city is run by, in many respects, I would say that most politicians, at least in Florida, certainly in Fort Lauderdale, are somewhat psychopathic. I mean, they seem to lack just a basic sense of moral, you know, guidance or decency. You know, it's I don't know how you can see an old homeless woman beg you to not pass a law and then pass it, you know. So these politicians are in certain respects, they are sick people, and the police department, which they foster in many respects, also makes their own version of sick people. Albeit I think that the whole police situation structural issue that can be fixed and should be fixed, you know, and I'm running to counter this complete disconnect between the city government and the people of that city.
How much of that is due to local lobbying by the local rich business owners like the Tim Petrellas of the world? It's probably mostly due to that, I would think.
Yeah. Well, you know, the city of Fort Lauderdale has a lot of very sheltered rich people. What do I mean by that? These are rich people who were rich because their daddy was rich, and their daddy was rich because their granddaddy was rich. So they're very removed from the world of cutthroat politics. And so that actually leaves us with a, I would say, very incompetent high class in Fort Lauderdale, which has made so many political mistakes in the last year that, you know, you're surprised that they don't even know how to respond to a simple protest without freaking out and making things worse, you know? I mean, again, the whole Arnold Abbott thing, did they know about Arnold Abbott? Did they know that was going to happen, you know? So
right. Lobbying,
it's, you know, in Fort Lauderdale the same way it's everywhere in the U.S., our advantage here is that the rich people of Fort Lauderdale are very, ineffective, or at least as they're not as effective as they wish they could be in their political endeavors.
What's the job situation like in Fort Lauderdale? Is there high unemployment, or is it turnaround?
It's the same situation as the whole county, you know, the same situation as the whole state. To be honest, you know, Fort Lauderdale has a wide variety of lifestyle, you know, there's suburban areas where, you know, middle-class people live, but there's also high-rich areas, you know. There's an unemployment problem, you know, in my district.
Your district is far by 441. You're not by the condos by the beach. You're clear
no,
away
no.
from that.
No,
yeah,
we
well
are
west
in...
of I-95. So you're
Yeah,
the ideal district actually. So you're it's a district that I would assume would be traditionally Democrat, not and a
it
Republican
is.
Wouldn't bother stepping foot in it.
No. I mean, Bobby DuBose, our state representative, the newly elected person to be state representative, his name was the only name on the ballot in November, so, you know.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
So you're running to the left of him, of course, which is good.
Yeah.
It should be pretty easy to do that with the local politicians we have down here. Mayor Jack Seiler, who signed off on the homeless hate ban, is a Democrat, supposedly.
He also voted against gay marriage. There was a resolution presented earlier this year, and you know, Jack Seiler was one of the people that voted against the resolution to support marriage equality and to ask the state government to pass the law as soon as possible.
Why would he do that? You know, it's kind of bizarre. Broward County is supposed to be the most progressive part of the entire state.
Mm.
Which is a pretty sad statement. You know,
not. Yeah, it's, I don't know why he did that. I mean, he tried, I read a little bit about it. I can't tell you I read that much about it, but he has a very particular difficult condition with gay people. He supported the right, I think, to the civil unions, but he hasn't evolved to gay marriage yet. I don't think with that record he's going to try to run for a higher office.
I don't know. The Florida is strange. I mean, as Andrew Markoff, who came on the show, well, he's a local Democratic Party activist, stated that the well than more than half the gays in the state of Florida are registered Republicans. Okay, so it's just you have a whole bunch of people that vote for against their own interests because they're more interested in the harsher economic agenda. Yeah,
I mean,
go ahead.
It could be that he's lying. I mean, to my understanding, there is no box or line in voter, you know, registration form that says, "Are you gay?" So there's
no
official way to
claim
that or to counter cross-reference that. You know, it's just.
No, I think when Andrew stated that, he was stating that based on personal experience, and actually, from what I've met, he's probably right. So, yeah, it's not a surprise. Mainly because again, you have especially say in South Beach area. Which has a high population of gays, but they're also wealthy, and they tend to vote more to the right, due to the wealth. And that's probably why the Republican Party, even though gave this messaging of anti-gay message, they pretty much had to bend and allow marriage equality to occur anyway. And those states that are in the deep south that are far red are having their bans against marriage equality being lifted one by one anyway, I've noticed. So usually by some federal judge.
Yeah.
Some local federal judge. But body cameras sounds like a very good direction to go. Is that the solution? Is that the answer to stop police brutality?
That's part of the answer. I mean, there's more to it than that. I think that if you have a board that, you know, has a lot of control or significant control over the police, made up of community, you know, members, you know, in a cycling manner, right, a rotating manner, so that there's not one person in that position, you know, for too long. Basically, a board or a committee that decides the routes that the police follow, the protocols that they adhere to, the weapons that they can brand, the vehicles that they can drive, and so forth. You know, that would also alleviate the problem, as well as independent investigation unit with subpoena power. You know, so it's a lot of things, you know, but. I feel that the most obvious one is the camera and the police, and I feel that I will not encounter much opposition, at least in my district, for that.
I think to a point, body cameras is an excellent idea, because I gather that when police have them, there's resistance at first, but then they actually come to like it. For example, if some police have to deal with a violent domestic dispute, and one of the couples that was making accusation against the other denies making that accusation later on, the cop easily pulls off the film and says, "See, you did say that," and so it helps the cops. So I mean, once it actually works for them, they tend to like it. It's only a few bad apples that don't. I think the underlying issue that has to be addressed ultimately is massive economic inequality that creates the underlying stresses in our society that basically help enhance this police brutality. You know, it's
a higher minimum wage.
A higher minimum, a bunch of things. I mean, you have, well, I'll talk about that now, then I'll get back to what I was about to bring up. But, yeah, one of your campaigns is also regarding a 15 minimum wage. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, basically, you know, there's actually a law in Florida that bars cities from passing higher minimum wages than the state or federal minimum wages.
Yeah.
But the Constitution of Florida also says that the workers have a right to a living wage. So the first thing that we would do is that we would pass a resolution, you know, decreeing that we believe that law is unconstitutional according to the Florida Constitution. And then we would ask directly the state government to correct this. And so that would be the first step. We would also make a commitment to raise the minimum wage to $15 as soon as that unconstitutional law is stricken down in the Florida Supreme Court. So that will be our first step into the $15 minimum wage.
The 15 now campaign. But you won't be able to. So basically you have to get the state to change a law before you're allowed to push forward on the $15 minimum wage. How confident are you that you can make that change? Because the state government is also, unfortunately, not progressive in the slightest.
Well, then the Florida Supreme Court.
Okay.
But one of the things about making a minimum law, a thing like, okay, $15, in this law there needs to be some kind of a progressive component, because, I mean, look at the way things are now. With the minimum laws that people have had, they've been in place for years and years, and the cost of living just keeps going up. So while you want a certain hourly wage right now, there needs to be written up about how the increments will change over time.
Yeah, I think that.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Tied to some type of index, like a cost of living adjustment.
Perhaps. I mean, for now, I think that workers need higher access to money, you know, higher standard of living. There's many factors that increase housing, you know, apart from the rising of wages.
Right.
But yeah, I think for now the $15 minimum wage might be a solution. You know, as obviously a lot of these problems have even deeper structural, you know, components to them. But I think for now, I think at least as a first step, we should increase the minimum wage to $15 now.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. An excellent idea. When was this law put in place to prevent municipalities and cities from raising their minimum wages?
Well, that law passed a few years ago, actually, when some folks in Orlando attempted to get a higher minimum wage, a ballot question in an election in the county in which Orlando is in.
What a wonderful law for Rick Scott to put in place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I gather that was probably the first of many attempts. Well, wasn't there an attempt to pass a law preventing wage theft in this state that was it was pretty much killed, I think, even before it got to Rick Scott's desk?
I mean,
wage theft has been a big problem in the state. In other words, you work at Walmart, you do overtime, but they just neglect to pay it to you, or you sell a house and you don't get paid your commission because the firm fires you, decides to, and keep the commission to itself. And I mean, the list goes on. There's wage theft all the time in this state. It's just not talked about. And there was a law put forth to prevent it, but it never got anywhere. Are you aware of it, Lydia?
A little bit of it, but certainly not as aware of it as you are.
It's okay, dude. It's okay. Now, regarding the income inequality, I mean, some stats came out that it's just gotten massively worse, where the top 10% saw continued increase in their income. This is starting from 2008, the economic recovery. Over half the income increase went to 1% of the population. The rest of it went to the top 10%. For the middle-tiered income, wages stayed effectively flat, and for everybody else, incomes slid downward. So that's just consistently getting worse. And since the tax burden is falling more on the poor and less than the rich, there's no way to fund social services, and it's even straining the budgets of police departments. So you have increased poverty in poor areas, which increases crime, but they're not really hiring the number of police that they should be. They're not giving them the proper training that they used to, and so forth. And so the police are getting stressed out too. And to top it off, they tend to end up becoming very right-wing minded, so you end up with a very brutal police force. So you have these added stressors in our society that's actually measurable on a lot of levels, going on just from that. I think if you compare over the last two decades, people taking antidepressants, there's something like a 400% increase in people taking antidepressants. You know, and the number of people committing suicide from the late 1990s till now increased by 29%.
Yeah.
You know, if you go back to, you know, 50 years ago, the average age at which people were experiencing the first onset of depression was around 30 years old. Now the average age for the onset of depression is around 14 years old. You know, I mean, so definitely the society is a lot more stressed out than it was. And I think the police brutality is sort of a symptom of it in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a hard
thing to get. Right. I mean, yeah, it's a lot of this is including, I think, a sort of white, not guilt, but pressure, uneasiness with the reality of a somewhat developing black American ethnic group. I think the post-racial racism of today is, you know, a product, well, actually it's a symptom of this guilt, of this sort of pressure and backlash, right? And so police brutality is part of the backlash, a part of course, being in many respects structurally troubling and flawed, you know?
Well, I view that as kind of manufactured. I mean, because people's lives are definitely getting more stressed as the capitalism gets harsher, people have to work harder, they have to go work longer hours, they're not making enough. The social services aren't there that used to be, because you keep on having cuts over the years. And so people are developing psychological issues. Actually, that's one of the reasons I think that all of a sudden now, over the last couple of years, has been this great progressive demand to legalize marijuana. I think the society is stressed out and wants to escape. I'm not just a real kid, you know. But you know, and so what you're describing, I mean, that's kind of, you know, you're feeling bad and so forth, and it's because of this group of people, they're taking over. You know, I think a part of the media is telling that to them. You know, your life is getting worse because these people are taking over. And
oh,
so
yeah.
I don't think that's an innate fear. I think that's kind of that fear is partly manufactured, I think, by the Fox Newses of the world and so forth. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's just a way to keep people divided, you know what I mean? The realities that they're mentioning made in a working class dimension, a working class form of unity. I think racism really, obviously the origins of racism in America are economical, right? And they're still economical.
Yeah.
I mean, you can just look at our history of immigration law, which was mostly based on just bigotry and superstitions, right? But yeah, I mean, it's a way to keep the conversation about really stupid things like the war on Christmas or Benghazi or racism or so, just something which, you know, it's just a distraction from the real issue, which is...
Big distraction, but it's also a great way to control the population, especially racism, as you said, it keeps people at each other's throats. And the layer of racism can be pretty deep. I've seen it even in people that were liberals, or I thought were. I mean, for example, take the a lot of the protests are regarding the death of a. I mean, it goes beyond Ferguson, Missouri. After that, and definitely what brought it all to a higher crescendo was the death of Eric Garner, and the video of him being choked to death by the police officer. And you see him talking, being somewhat agitated to the police, so he's not being quiet and obedient, but he doesn't appear to be threatening the police officer. And matter of fact, even I think initially, even the right-wing media seemed to agree that perhaps this was a case that went a bit too far. But once there was a grand jury that refused to indict that police officer, it gave it validity, you know, that officer didn't do any wrongdoing, and all of a sudden, when people looked at that video from there on in, it seemed like if you were racist, you saw that video as the black guy deserving it, you know, and others looked at the video and just were in sheer horror of what just happened. I mean, it's beyond me how you can look at that video and basically feel that guy deserved it. But, I mean, I've heard that from people that are racist. I mean, they see it and they, well, I mean, he wasn't being obedient, so therefore it's strange how deep the racism gets, you know?
It's crazy. I mean, a lot of these folks, they've been raised in environments where bigotry and superstition were the only guides of life, the only real concrete things that he knew about life. It's when you live in a box, I mean, you have to know things, because a lack of being certain about things just creates such a big fear in people, you know, who don't dare to go beyond their context. So it's a shame. It's a shame that a lot of people feel like they must defend the status quo, and they must defend, you know, just the same old, because they've been taught that's really the only certainty they will ever have, you know?
Yeah. It's basically they want to maintain a status quo, and they're certainly not class conscious, as most Americans aren't, and so they're viewing life in a very narrow spectrum. Not going beyond their neighborhood.
I just spent some time over this past weekend with a person who is gung-ho for all the torture, and he doesn't understand why people are down on Cheney and Bush and the CIA. If you can imagine. And this person, you know, in many ways is not a bad, not a, you know, quote-unquote bad person, but totally oblivious another.
He buys the ticking time bomb argument. I mean, that issue shouldn't even be politicized. Torture is torture, and it's wrong. Period.
I know.
You know,
I said something about that woman, and he was like, "Oh no, you know, yeah, they're supposed to torture and blah." And I'm like, you know, they've never gotten any information that, you know, this is horrible.
Yeah, I totally, you know, Obama is to blame for part of that by letting everybody off the hook. In fact, some of the people that promoted torture got cushier jobs in the government. It's so wrong. So I mean, it sort of gave it validity. So even though he took out torture from the Army manual and so forth, it could easily be put in by the next president. You know, I mean, it's unless somebody is prosecuted, you're giving a very bad message, and we're going to have this ongoing debate in the mainstream media between Republicans and Democrats whether torture has some validity. It's a debate that shouldn't even be occurring. You know, I mean, a ticking time bomb argument for torture is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. If you torture a person, that person may likely just say anything you want to hear just to get the torture to stop.
Yeah, they say that they have never gotten any real information. And, it's horrid. We only have...
Torture does work. It works.
3 minutes left.
Confessions.
So,
yes. Do you want to say some final words, Didier?
Well, basically, if you want to learn more about the campaign, you can go to facebook.com/Ortiz for Commissioner. And if you want to learn more about the Broward County Green Party, you can go to facebook.com/BrowardGP and follow us on Twitter at BrowardGP. My own Twitter account is at Diddy Ortiz. That's at BIDDYORTIZ. And if you want to email me, my email is DIDDYORTIC@gmail.com.
Oh, Didier, thank you very much. We have to have you come back, and I definitely hope you win.
Oh,
thank
yeah.
Thank you so much.
And I want to see how I can help you.
Thank you so much. Y'all have a good one. Bye.
You take care. Oh, we still have a few minutes left.
Yeah, happy New Year.
Well, I mean, one thing that I would ask, you know, the people who are listening to the show is that I feel that we have a really good chance of winning. Not only is it a nonpartisan race, so, you know, it's not an issue of whether I'm a Green member or not, but also it's an open race. There's no incumbent. The incumbent got promoted to a higher office. It's a minority-majority district. You know, it's really a dynamic campaign. My campaign, you know, features a lot of things that you're not going to see in regular campaigns, including a very good amount of activists who are there, you know, ready to provide support and you know, power in our movement. And it's a movement that's capturing the imaginations of a lot of people, you know, have endorsement of certain, you know, supporters and others that are preparing their endorsements, which hopefully I'll be able to reveal, you know, in the upcoming days. But it's a great campaign. Again, you know, Diddy Ortiz, DIDIERORTIZ, and, you know, facebook.com/Ortiz for Commissioner.
Sounds good.
Definitely.
Sounds good. Well, I guess we should wrap it right here, Ruthann, and we'll talk to thank you very much, Didier. We'll have to have you
thanks
come back
so
in a future show. And
bye.
We'll
thank
see everybody
so
next week.
See you. Bye.
And we'll be back next year. Don't you love being able to
next year.
So everybody be safe. And come back just raring to go. Let's make some changes in this country, people.
I agree.
Well, and the world. But, you know, we start where we are. So.